Hi, it's your old pal Slim welcoming you to a very special episode of The Letterbox Show. We've got actor, director, and musician Patrick Wilson here to chat about his directorial debut, Insidious: The Red Door, in U.S. theaters now, courtesy of Sony. The horror movie follows the Lambert family 10 years after the events of Insidious Chapter 2. They decided to completely block out those events. But those forgotten memories have caused unforeseen problems over the years, and their family life now kinda sucks. And Josh is off to college, unable to find common ground with his dad. In this conversation, Patrick and I talk about focusing on realistic family issues coming to the Lamberts, the importance of Goblin to horror cinema, how Fast Five showed him you can rejuvenate a franchise, his popularity on my man-ass letterbox list, and me calling Insidious: The Red Door the Babadook for divorced dads. Don't worry, no spoilers. Without further ado, here is our conversation. So, just to start off, how does it feel to be a Scream King? Do you take that mantle seriously at this point?
I mean, it's of course a compliment. I guess the opposite would be, how does it feel to be a guy that's in a bunch of horror movies and nobody knows who you are? So, I guess that's the other side of it. Listen, horror fans are fantastic fans and are rabid fans, and it's a fantastic fan base. So I'm proud of the moniker. I will tell you that. Sure.
Fantastic. So with this movie, you're making your directorial debut with The Red Door, the third chapter for the Lambert family as they struggle to forget the events of the first two. So when the first one came out, you know, my wife and I fell in love. We love watching horror movies. It had just the right amount of jump scares. And then the second one drifted into the paranormal a little bit more, which I loved. And you and James Wan eventually worked together on many other things, including The Conjuring. But did you get the sense while filming Insidious that you two kind of were like cooking with gas and you might be in for the long haul with these characters?
Not with Insidious, honestly, because when we did the first one and I was hoping we'd come back and do the second one. And I remember he called me and pitched me on Conjuring. At the time, it was called The Warren Files. It was not called The Conjuring. Mm. And he wanted me to do it. And I remember thinking, I haven't told this in interviews. This is a little nugget everyone gets that I haven't said. And I remember telling him, if I do this movie, are we still going to go back and do Insidious 2? Because I really wanted to do my version of Jack Torrance. Like I had no concept of really what Conjuring would become. It was just an idea. And so he says, no, we do Conjuring, then we go back and do Insidious 2. And I was like, all right, let's go for it. So I sort of went back and forth between these two franchises. But once I did the second movie, I thought I kind of put Josh Lambert to bed. It just, nothing against the franchise, it was awesome. I honestly had a great time, but it was like, if you're playing the subject of the movie, meaning you're playing, it's the reason like in Conjuring, you don't have the same family twice. We're the Lambert family. So I figure, well, the kid's been possessed, then I've been possessed, like what's left? I mean, he wasn't possessed. He was just captured in the further. You know what I mean? It was just, what's there else to do with the character? Like I can't play a victim anymore. So it really wasn't until, you know, 4 years ago, and they went and did 3 and 4 and prequels, and Lynn was fantastic. And really the through line between all the movies. And then when they came with this idea, I was like, oh, this is actually a great, cool idea. First of all, him going to college and then it kind of turning it on its head. But wow, what a bonus. I can use footage of him as a kid, you know, and I really wanted to unpack the second movie and the trauma that they went through. And I was like, oh, this is fantastic. And I really kind of built the whole movie around the basement laundry room sequence, really. That was like my most important kind of linchpin. So that's where it started.
Yeah. I was thinking about, I kind of avoided all trailers before I saw it this week.
Oh, good for you.
And I think that benefited me fantastic because I didn't realize that the kind of realistic interplay with like the divorced dad energy and the son going to college, after I left, I almost felt like it was the Babadook for divorced dads. And I love the Babadook.
Yeah, that's cool. I haven't heard that. Yeah. I love that movie too.
Yeah, this one opens with the idea of kind of forgetting trauma at the end of chapter two. And you think that would be the end of the story, but I love how it opens with that causing more problems for the family. You know, that family is now in a worse place because of forgetting that trauma. And I want to spotlight a Letterboxd review that said the same thing recently. Patrick Wilson has his little Jack Torrance moment here from chapter two. And it's almost like, what if that family made it out of the maze? What would they be like 10 years later? You know, I find that so fascinating. So I thought it was an amazing turn for this movie.
Yeah, that's what I wanted. And it's funny, there were so many variables of this process that were new, right? Everything. I haven't directed a film before. But I knew I needed to make a story that I believed in, that I was passionate about. And so when I pitched really my idea, which we had the kernel of Lee's idea, and I remember thinking, I said, if I'm in this movie in any capacity, like I'm not, first of all, I don't really want to be in the movie, you know, but if I'm in it, if I'm going to play Josh Lambert, I am going to address what happened at the end of Insidious 2. Like what does that do to someone over 9 years? Like it has to come out. Like, and when it does, what's he going to do? Turn to his wife and go, you know, well, there's the scene. Like what the hell? You lied to me? What, you know, it's so the breakdown of communication, the secrets, the deception, all this, you know, understanding trauma, reliving trauma, going through, you know, the father-son dynamic. There were all these very, very heavy laden themes that I just felt really excited about exploring, because you could never explore that in an adult drama in a studio movie. They don't make those anymore. Like, they just don't do it, you know, not on a studio scale. It would be on, you know, Apple or something. Nothing offense, right. No offense to Apple, but you're not making I'm not going to the theater to see an adult drama about family trauma and dealing with, like, it's not going to happen. But through a horror movie, I can do it. And it lends itself to that. And I think the great horror movies do have that. Really, these real, real emotional core. And then you can just blow it out of the water. And Insidious has such a weird, avant-garde, quirky side to it that I thought I wanted to explore as well, hence the ending. So I wanted both. I wanted to go for both in the same movie.
Yeah. Yeah, I watched Insidious Chapter 2 recently for the first time. I watched it in my basement with my headphones on. And I honestly, like, I was crapping my pants because my son had come down at one point and, like, tapped me on the shoulder and I swung around and it added to the horror of the movie.
Yeah.
But I guess really with that movie, I felt like it surpassed even the original. You know, does that free things up for you as a director to try to take those chances, or did that make you nervous at all? Like, oh, I'm adding
to the lore.
It
doesn't make me nervous because I think the expectations just on paper of a movie and a fifth in a franchise, I mean, with the exception of, like, when Fast Five rebooted the Fast and Furious franchise, and I don't even mean that flippantly, that did happen. That actually was always in the back of my mind. Like, it can be done. Like, you can reinvigorate a franchise after five. Like, okay, like, let's do it. Like, I really did use that as it's weird. It has nothing to do with my movie, but I always did sort of think, like, God, what do you do after five movies? Because the list is long of movies that have just gone downhill. And I didn't want that. I viewed this as really the Lambert trilogy. So I kept tying it to the first two. And I think because it was a fifth movie, because it was me at the helm, because it was a new writer and Scott Teams doing it, I knew if we just stayed truthful to ourselves, it was going to feel different. It was both going to honor the franchise, but move it forward. And I kept always reminding everyone of that. Every time I would get a, shouldn't this be at night? Shouldn't this be more of a jump scare and less of a tonal scare? And I would say, do you want to move this forward, or do you just want me to try to regurgitate what's done? Like, I'm not getting any better than this head behind my head, like, has been in every meme for the past 15 years. I mean, nor do I want to try, you know, like, that's dumb. It's already been done. So I'm going to do something different. I'm going to pick and choose from other movies and other movies that meant something to me, whether it's a horror movie or not, you know? So that's where I landed on some of these scares that are different. You know, there are definitely some jump scares in the movie that really make people jump, and I love it. There are also some just kind of creepy scares that are by design as well. And some that turns into an action sequence. And that's good. Mm-hmm. That's what I wanted.
Yeah, when I was in the theater, it was just me and the security guard watching it the other day. And I remember yelling out during the first jump scare, "Jesus Christ," at the top of my lungs. And I heard him laughing in the hallway.
That's good.
What were some horror movies that you grew up on? Do you have any like vivid memories of some really, really good ones? Maybe you saw too young or too early?
Salem's Lot, I saw on TV in the 70s. Yeah. But what I would have been, I guess, maybe 78, 79.
Yeah, probably late. Yeah.
Yeah. I was probably five or six. Should Jeez. Not have seen it. Kid scratching on the window. Terrified uh-huh. me so much that when I was a teenager and wanted to watch horror movies with my friends, I was like, I'm not watching that. That movie scared the shit out of me when I was a kid. I'm not doing it. It's so terrible. It's so scary to me. And they're like, "We're going to watch it." And I was so nervous that I was like, oh, it's kind of sweet.
It's never as scary as that, like almost first moment, first memory you have of seeing it.
I agree. I agree. But then I'll have a movie like Jaws to me that, you know, is loosely in the genre. But that, I mean, I was on 2 days ago and I saw a shot that I'd never seen before. And I love that. Nothing makes me happier than watching a movie that I assume you too, but when you grow up with them, watching something over and over, like Silence of the Lambs, the same way, over and over and over. I've seen that movie so many times. And then when you see something, you go, "Oh, that's awesome. Never saw that before." Pause it, show my son, "You see this? This is so cool." And, you know, and I nerd out and I love that. And it's sort of seeing movies at a different place in your life. You know, I do that a lot with my kids. "I want to see The Shining." You're like, You'll see it. You won't get it. Like, it's not going to resonate to you. Can you just wait? "Why? I've seen all the Jason movies." You know, you're like, it's not about the violence. It's just, it's not going to land on you yet. You know, you're going to be bored. You're going to say, "I saw The Shining," but you're not going to enjoy it. Those movies that sort of resonate to me later in life, actually. But Silence of the Lambs, Jaws, those are big ones for me that resonate with me more. I mean, in this research and really taking a deep dive into a lot of 70s horror, I really did find a new love with that. A lot of early Argento and Mario Bava, and even later like 80s, like Phenomena with Jennifer Connelly. Like I like when it gets weird. I do. I like totally bizarre supernatural elements, borderline melodrama. I think it's cool. I think it's really, I love the fearlessness of a lot of European directors. And I don't think that a lot of typical American directors do that, but horror gives you that place, you know? All of a sudden, if you're so sort of seemingly avant-garde, it's like Wes Anderson, who I adore. He's one out of, it's so hard to find that kind of swinging a big stick with production design or concepts. American audiences don't tend to do that, I think, like European audiences. That's why we can lean on those on sort of the Italian masters, to me at least.
I got the 4K of Suspiria a couple of years ago and I played it and it was mind-blowing. It was just like visual and vibes.
The music is incredible. The music is incredible. Yeah.
Goblin, my God.
Goblins. Oh yeah. They were touring. They did a thing and they did a tour of, I don't know if they're still doing it. Did you see them? Did you see it?
No, I haven't seen them live.
Yeah, they were doing a tour of the soundtrack.
Oh my God.
Pretty recently. Yeah, I know.
So with your movie, we talked about the visuals, but I feel like you did something different with the visuals of this movie. You did kind of like that inverted point of view where you're looking at a character for a long time and it almost tricks the viewer into thinking that like, oh shit, something's about to happen.
Right.
But then it doesn't happen. It's almost like subverts your expectations. I guess that had to have been maybe like an early on decision from you to try something different there.
Yeah. I didn't want to overpromise and underdeliver. But luckily I'm also, by the way, surrounded by people that also want to push the genre as well. So, you know, that's, you know, sometimes you want to give the audience what they want. And sometimes you want to take it away and just do not give it to them at all. And then have it come from somewhere else. I mean, that's when it's good, that's what I enjoy. You know, finding the rhythm it actually is very musical, finding the rhythm of a scene so that it really can scare you. That's really exciting to me. And then when you get into the sound and color, then it really comes alive, because so much of it is, if I can't hear it, if I don't understand, you know, the absence of sound. That was something Lee was super helpful with. You know, take the sound out there. God, I didn't even think of that. You know, like late game stuff. I mean, I love that, you know, because ultimately, you know, you'd have these guys present these ideas and say, try this. You may not like it, because they know that everything, every take, tone, every question goes through. We like it. Do you? And you're like, can we try this? Sure. And then you do something different. So you end up being the last voice. So if nothing else, it's all my taste. So whether take it or leave it, it's me.
So I know I'm running out of time. I do have to bring up one thing. You know, on Letterboxd, movie lovers can make lists of movies. They can combine different sorts of movies that fit a theme. So there's like an all vibes, no plot list that Suspiria is on a lot of. But I made a list that's kind of popular, which you've played a part in. It's called the Man Ass List, and it features only movies where men bare their ass in the movie.
Solid.
Because that list exists in large part due to Todd Field's Little Children.
Yes.
And did you know that your scene could resonate with so many Letterboxd users over the years? Like, you're kind of like at the higher echelon of Letterboxd faves because of that movie.
That's good. I did not know that. It's good to know. It's good to know. I do remember. Here's a funny story. Here's a funny story. Speaking of bearing butt, we were rehearsing for Bone Tomahawk. You got me, Richard Jenkins, Kurt Russell, our director, Craig Zoller, maybe Matt Fox was there. I'm not sure. And they were about to cast the kid who, young actor who got split open at the end. Right. And he had to bare his ass. We had to see him naked, and the kid would not do it. And we're listening to Craig on this call say, well, it's okay. We can put clothes on him. And all of a sudden you heard me and Kurt going, no, he's got to bear his ass. And we all look around like, you bared your ass? Yeah, I did it. You bared your ass? Yeah. Richard Jenkins like, yeah, well, yeah, several times I have. We all went around the room. We're like, no, if we can bear our ass and this no-name guy can bear his butt, tell him to do it or don't hire him. Greg's like, okay. And he agreed, and the scene works. So sometimes you got to
movie magic right there.
If you got
movie magic, you got to add it to my list.
Do you have a four faves? Do you have like a top list of like movies you'd watch over and over again? Maybe you have any posters in your house of just all-time favorite movies? I know that's a lofty question.
It is a lofty question, because I think there are two things in there. It's like, usually when I say movies that I love are like my favorite movies, that usually movies that I grew up on, I don't know that they're movies that I watch over and over, but movies that I will watch over and over, off the top of my head, yeah, it's going to be like Fletch. It's going to be Heat. It's going to be, you know, I'd love to say Godfather 2, because it's one of my favorite movies ever. I don't know that I'm watching it front to back like a lot, you know. It's usually got to be something a little more snappy, I guess, if I'm really going to watch something over and over. Those are two movies that Raiders. I can watch that, put that on at any point. Yeah, those are movies to me that kind of just make me, I can sit down and feel good. And it's very hard to switch the channel. It's very hard to. When we were in production, they had all these horror movies up on the walls, posters, sort of like our production office. Somebody even put up like, do you mind if we put up a Conjuring poster? Like, because it's Insidious. I was like, do I mind? No, I don't mind. You know, but here's the deal. If you put up Conjuring, you have to put up Fletch right next to it. So it was all these horror movies and Fletch. So I was like, it's pretty much me right there. So there you go.
Thanks so much for listening to The Letterboxd Show. Our guest today was Patrick Wilson, and Insidious: The Red Door is in U.S. theaters now. You can also watch the first two chapters and have a little date night, as they're both streaming on Max in the U.S., Maybe consider leaving us a review on Apple Podcasts if you're so inclined, as it helps spread the word about the show. And thanks to our crew, our editorial producer, Brian Formo, our booker, Sophie Shin, Sam for the art, Joseph Bishar for the Insidious score, which is amazing, and to you for listening. The Letterboxd Show is a Tape Deck production.
This is a Tape Deck Podcast.